So, I am going to talk today about black markets. I've actually blogged about the topic of black markets before. As some of you may or may not know, when I lived in Seattle, I lived there, before marijuana was legalized. And when I lived in Seattle, I had to participate in black markets. So if you have to buy weed anywhere it is not currently legal, that's pretty much your only option. And even where it's legal, given the way in which it's legal, black markets still function. So it's not as if that problem was really completely cured. To be honest with you, I've visited both Colorado and Washington State, and the way in which they've legalized marijuana is kind of ridiculous. It's certainly treated much worse than alcohol or cigarettes. And yet, I can't for the life of me see how it is more dangerous than one or both of those, but certainly probably far less dangerous than both or either. Anyways, black markets are interesting because there are a lot of assumptions people make about black markets that are false. Like, there are a lot of anarchists who look at black markets as kind of a sign of freedom. And in a way, I guess they are kind of a sign of freedom. They're sort of a free kind of place in a way. The problem is that black markets have pretty much no system of proper adjudication or ways or means by which people can actually fix problems. So much of the fixing amounts to violence. So I'm going to give you my perspective of the black market, and it's really kind of from a personal perspective, and you can think of it as a sort of narrative, but it also is kind of a description of a system. My introduction to the black market was basically through a friend at work. I was working at Getty Images, and this was the spring of 2008. And I had a friend at work who basically had a guy, and for purposes of this conversation, a guy or a dude or a person or a guy is basically the dealer, the person, the primary point of contact in the customer relationship model that is marijuana drug dealing. So my friend at work had a guy, he knew a dude. And I'd never really been into marijuana that much. In fact, prior to that point, I've smoked it a few times, but I'd never really had, a connection. And I'd never really been in a culture where it was so accepted. Because for the most part, and I don't think I'm speaking out of school here, and it could be true of other places as well. So I'm only talking about Seattle right now. But for the most part, most of the software engineers I met in Seattle smoked marijuana. I mean, I would say probably half the code that gets written in Seattle is probably under the influence of weed. I don't know if that makes people feel better or worse. I think it's partly related to the nature of the work itself. Writing code can kind of suck the life out of you because it's a creative process, but it's sort of a not very human creative process. I mean, it's really more human to write poetry than it is to write code. So anyways, it sucks the life out of you, and that's why I understand why people do it. It's why I understand why I kind of got into it. So my entry to this black market was through a friend at work and a friend who had a dude. And for about a year, that was kind of my relationship to the black market through a friend who knew a dude. The problem is that I hate that. It put my friend under pressure. It kind of made the relationship sort of artificial. And so I had to come up with a solution. And so the solution was sort of messy, and it involved basically doing some research. And so the first aspect of black markets that I'm discussing right now is the sort of hidden nature of them. Now, I'll say hidden sort of because you'll say, well, Dan, what do you mean hidden? That black markets are hidden. Well, they're not necessarily hidden. I mean, in really corrupt societies where everything's a kickback and where there's basically two systems, a system on the surface and the system that's hidden, nothing is really hidden because it's everywhere. You know, the corruption is everywhere. So, you know, when I say black markets are hidden, what I should really say is that the means by which you interact with black markets can seem encrypted in a sense. It can seem hidden or encrypted or made to seem mysterious, but when in fact it isn't that mysterious at all. So I did some research, and there's a corner of, I want to say 50th Street and University Avenue in the U District. I could be wrong there, but let's just say 50th and University. And there's a Jack in a Box there. And I'm not going to talk about the Jack in a Box because really it's kind of gross. But here's the deal. Back in the day, and it's probably still true because, like I said, the system itself isn't really operating the way we expected it to with the legalization. I mean, you know, I think we should be able to go and buy weed the way we would buy cigarettes or alcohol, and certainly at least at the level of alcohol. But no, it doesn't really work that way where it's legal. It feels a lot like you're going to get your methadone. That being said, right there in the corner of 50th and University, there's usually a few dealers hanging out, but you really just can't go up to them and say, "Hey, dude, I'd like some weed," because in all likelihood, that's not going to turn out so well. And I'll also tell you this: if you're a white dude and you like to, you know, every once in a while get a short haircut, it can suck because when your hair is long, and basically, I cut my hair every 3 to 4 months, so there's like a month where my hair is ridiculously short. And then there's usually a month where my hair is ridiculously long. And if it's during the short hair month, this particular process is painful because people will look at you and they'll think you're a cop. But anyways, there's a process, and my process was simple. This was my entrance into the black market. Not my total entrance, but one of my entry points. I would go and park my car near the, I think it was a CVS about a block away. I'd leave my wallet, my cell phone, everything in my car but my car keys and the money I would need. And here's what you need to know. On the street at the time, a dub, or like probably I'd say an eighth, but I really don't know, because honestly, I never really weighed the shit. A dub was $20. So $20 was a dub, and I'd usually pick up a couple dubs, and it's basically, you know, I'd pick up $40 worth of weed. And what it was, it amounted to me walking around the block, and I'd walk up University Avenue heading north towards the Jack in the Box, and I would be walking, you know, on the left-hand side of the street if I'm going north, which means the Jack in the Box side. And I would walk along, and I'd walk kind of all relaxed and like nonchalant, and frankly, you know, whether my hair was long or not, I always wore clothes that made me look like a kind of hobo anyways. And I would give the guy a look, and it'd be like that look. It'd be hard to explain, but it would be like you'd make eye contact, but only for a second, and it'd be like this glance and a little head nod that took about half a second. And that little handshake, almost like TCPIP in the world of networking, and if you are into computers, and you don't have to be, you know what I'm talking about, that little handshake actually enabled the entire transaction to begin. Once that began, the dude would walk up close to you so that he could whisper, "Hey, dude, what do you want?" And I'd say, "Hey, man, you know, some chronic." And it'd be like, you know, two dubs. Or usually I would just say two dubs. And it would be that fast. And I'd pass him 40, and he'd pass me two dubs. And I would walk my opposite direction, and he'd go one direction. And that entire transaction, if done correctly, takes about 5 seconds. Now, of course, if you're a white bread person and you think about the whole drug dealer thing and black markets, it all freaks you out. But once you understand the dynamics of it, you know that the whole thing is designed to be safe. Like, the reason why they don't want you to have the short haircut is because, hey, they don't want to have to worry about whether you're a cop or not. And that's the thing. It's confusing. It confuses the dynamics. Now, after I did this for a few months, I eventually made a relationship with a dude, and let's just and it was really funny at first because the first time I actually just tried to approach him on the street and he ran away from me because it was one of those short hair months and he thought I was a cop. but I wasn't a cop and I knew he was a dude. So I kind of just walked, within about 100 feet, almost like, I don't know, some, animal behavior expert or trainer. When you're approaching a skittish animal, you sort of just get all calm and shit and, whatever, and you just try to like not be non-threatening, blah blah blah. So I was all non-threatening and he approached me slowly and it became obvious to him I wasn't a cop, and he did the whole, stereotypical, "Are you a cop?" And I said, "No, I'm not a cop, man. I'm sorry my hair is short. It is short. I'm sorry about that, but there's no way in hell that I'm a cop." And so we did the first transaction, and that's how you get past the kind of street process. So there's, black markets have the kind of noisy street process, and that's all fine and good. But if you want to take your particular transactional situation to the next level, at least vis-a-vis this kind of black market, you have to find a guy or a dude, a dealer. And so this was a dealer that I found, and I got his mobile number, and I would text him these very brief messages, like, say, "Hey, are you available?" I would never use lingo in the text messages. I always thought that was kind of stupid. I don't know why he would respond with lingo. And when I say lingo, I mean specific words that identify the stuff in question. Like, I would say, "Hey, are you available?" And I would expect, as a text message response from a dealer that knew what the fuck they were doing, I would expect as a response as yes or no. And if the answer was yes, then I would respond, same as the last time. And it would be yes or no. And if it was yes, it was that simple. And it was just a question of, now and yes. And if yes was to now, then I would simply go to the location I knew of and take care of business. So none of that information ever had to be in a text message. In fact, if you do this process correctly, if the black markets run correctly, all the information required to actually conduct a transaction has to be spread into multiple locations. It can't be like in one location. You're not talking about an advertisement for, I don't know, Papa John's Pizza or something, where you're being told exactly where to go and what the deal is and what you can have. That really, if you do things that way in black markets, the authorities will come after you, because the authorities need you to hide it. They need you to keep it kind of hidden. So that hidden aspect is important. In fact, it's probably one of the most important aspects of it, because even though the tyranny and pretty much all forms of government have some tyrannical aspect, but even though the tyranny might say on the surface we despise the black market, in truth, most tyrannies historically love black markets, and we'll get to that in a moment. So once you find a person to work with, it can become an issue of being sort of stuck, because here's the deal: it is a black market. The truth is, if you find a dealer you like, in all likelihood, the dealer is under the same pressure you are. So it's not like you can say, "Oh, what you gave me was shit," or "it wasn't shit." I mean, every once in a while, I would get something that was total shit, and I would say, "Listen, dude, this was total shit. This was the worst shit you've ever given me. This was horrible shit. This tasted like something that you scraped from underneath a lawnmower. It was so bad." The problem is, though, in black markets, you really can't give feedback like that very often, if ever, even if you have a good relationship. And even then, the response will usually be, "Well, it's just what we had." And the other thing too is, I kind of feel sorry for these guys. And the more you get into a relationship with a specific dealer or dude or guy, the more you get into that relationship, the more it almost feels like almost a friendship kind of relationship, but at least a personal relationship. And in that sense, you have a hard time being too much of a dick. Like, hey, they have a livelihood too. So the thing about the situation is, it's hard to actually be a consumer. It's hard to make choices. You can't really make rational choices in these situations. You're basically stuck in a personal relationship that really should be a business relationship. Now, you can do dealer shopping, and that's one way in a black market to try to optimize your outcomes. But the problem is, even that's a little bit haphazard because it's not like dealers, list their names on some marketplace. It's not like there's a Angie's list for dealers, okay? That does not exist. And I'm not saying it should, okay? I'm saying it doesn't exist. So yes, dealer shopping is possible, but it's kind of a it doesn't really work that well. You can kind of say, well, I can go from dealer to dealer to dealer. And in black markets, whether it's drugs or guns or anything else, whether your dealer is dealing guns or dealing drugs or dealing derivatives or dealing whatever fucked up thing they're dealing in the black market, you really can't do much with pricing or supply on a dealer by dealer basis. You could only say, oh, I'll just go to another dealer. So if you don't like Goldman Sachs black markets or dark pools, you go to JP Morgan. Oh, I don't like JP Morgan, so I'll go someplace else. If you don't like one, illegal gun dealer, you'll go to a different one. But you really can't with any one dealer do much, negotiation. It's like the deal is the deal. There's not really a lot of flexibility. And I think that this leads to really poor moderation with respect to consumption. So if the black market is a black market and something that's related to a human desire, whether it's drugs or gambling or, sex, I think it can lead to immoderate behaviors because, again, there's no way to have a rational relationship with the black market. The black market is almost by its very nature a rather irrational proxy for a properly functioning market. In fact, in some ways, you could think of a black market as a zombie that sort of rises up when free markets are actually shut down. But zombies don't have brains and they pretty much eat brains. So that's the thing. Even though black markets might seem free and open and kind of like a free market, they're really, really not. The way in which, conflicts are adjudicated and dealt with is a matter of complete and total force. Or when it comes to the customers or clients or people who are actually buying things from a black market, for the most part, the customer is completely ignored. It's irrelevant. Black markets are a seller's market for all intents and purposes. That's why they exist. Now, the thing that people often get confused by is this whole thing. Well, black markets, it seems like tyrannical police state governments should despise black markets. And on the surface, as I've said before, they do. That is part of the propaganda. They'll say, we don't like black markets. But just like looking the other way with HSBC and Bank of America and JP Morgan and these banks that have been caught basically laundering money for ISIS and for terrorist organizations of other sorts. I mean, just like in that case, even though our own government says it doesn't like black markets, it looks the other way with the money laundering when it comes to the drugs and the terrorism. So it's funny, yeah, tyrannies say they don't like black markets, but if you really understand how black markets function, you understand that the more tyrannical a government becomes, the more a society sort of descends into a police state. The bigger the scope of the black market becomes bigger. The smaller the scope of the free market, the bigger the scope of the black market. And when I say black market, I'm not just talking about weed and drugs or sex or gambling or guns. I'm talking about, the black market that exists when it comes to kickbacks and greasing the wheels of governments and everybody wanting a bribe. Because when that kind of lawlessness in the civic world takes hold, and usually as a response of tyranny, it's difficult to get rid of. So that's kind of the thing about tyrannical systems, is that they almost by their very nature create the acidic structure that will destroy them. Black markets are insidious because they represent not simply the place you go to buy something you want to go buy, but they represent the kind of inherent, I don't know, the inherent sort of weakness of any type of authoritarianism. Black markets fill in the gaps where freedom once existed, and freedom wants to exist. Anyways, I don't want to get all philosophical, but the bottom line is this. People who think that our government having a national security state is somehow about not wanting a black market are idiots. In fact, the stronger our national security state becomes, the stronger the black market becomes. And if you don't believe me, just give it time. You'll see. You'll see. As the system fails, as the incredibly sclerotic and broken, quote unquote, free enterprise system falls apart, the black markets will become bigger and bigger and bigger. And some of them won't even seem like black markets. Some of them will seem like, just communities bartering food, bartering resources. And nobody would say, oh, that's wrong, that's illegal. But the problem is, in a tyrannical society, nothing is legal unless someone says it is. So everything is almost by definition illegal. And it doesn't really take that much, of a leap. They'll send the IRS after you. They'll say, "Oh, you're gonna barter your food and your resources." Well, where's the IRS's little cut? So when people talk about black markets, they often talk about them in terms of things that are sleazy, like sex and drugs and guns and stuff like that. But what they don't realize is that black markets exist in many forms. That, during the Soviet period, it wasn't just about, the sex and the drugs. In fact, it was mostly about the jeans and the Western rock and roll. During the 80s, during the 70s in the Soviet Union, it was about getting the consumer goods. It wasn't about getting the drugs for the most part. It was about that too, but it was about getting access to stuff that the system could not produce because it was that broken. The economic system had become so frozen, so incapable of flexibility, so completely stultified by the tyranny, that the only way to get something like a pair of jeans was basically on the black market. So, anyways, this is a weird sort of story, meditation, narrative to think about on a Sunday morning. But I thought it was worthy of some discussion. And just so you know, I myself am not proud of the fact that I've had to participate in black markets. I don't think it's cool. I don't think it's awesome. Actually, I hate black markets. I would prefer to participate in open and transparent markets. The problem is that these opaque black markets are simply a symptom of the deeper problem, and that is having a tyranny, a police state. So, anyways, I hope you guys have a great Sunday, and I will talk to you later. Bye-bye.